7th from noon to 7 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square, 700 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:59 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to the August 27th, 2018 edition of Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm Amanda Hill, here with my co-host Jamie Partridge.
Hey, Amanda.
Hey, Jamie. With us in the studio, we have Seamus Cook, who's an Oregon State employee and chief steward for SEIU 503. He's going to speak to us tonight about the effects of the Supreme Court decision in the Janus versus AFSCME case. We also were scheduled to have Jason Scheckler, who's a officer with the Carpenters Local 1503, here to discuss the rise of racist and fascist attacks in our communities. However, he was unable to make the show tonight, so we're going to quiz Seamus just a little bit on that as well. So welcome, Seamus.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Great. Let's start with you, Seamus. On June 27, 2018, the Supreme Court handed down their decision on the Janus case, which in effect prohibits public sector unions from collecting dues from non-members while compelling them to represent all employees under the contract. SEIU 503 represents both public and private sector members. Would you tell us how the decision has affected your union?
Well, I'll start by saying that this has been a pretty, you know, historic attack on labor. And I think in Oregon and elsewhere, we have yet to really understand fully the consequences of this. We're still kind of reeling in some ways. For example, my union, 80% of the public employees were members of the union. So that means 20% paid a fair share fee. And the Supreme Court, therefore, ruled that illegal. So now we lost 20% of our revenue of the whole union, the chief majority of the union finances. So we have a lot less money now. That affects all facets of the union, and we have to get those members back, basically. Turn them from being non-members to members, and that's a goal right now. But in the meantime, we're kind of like, well, how do we do that, you know, and how do we win them back, and how do we regain our power we lost?
So the Freedom Foundation, which is a Washington State libertarian think tank, has made it their mission to educate union members on their rights to give themselves a raise, or as they say, give themselves a raise, stop paying union dues, and even going door to door to do this. They're sending out mailers, they're making phone calls, they're knocking on union members' doors, saying, hey, give yourself a raise, stop paying union dues. So how's your union been dealing with these aggressive tactics? And maybe if you know about how other public sector unions are dealing with them.
Well, I'll say, first of all, that's a pretty compelling argument. You tell somebody you don't got to pay dues, you get a raise, and it seems like there's no repercussions, basically. So part of this for us is having discussions around what that really means. You can compare union dues to taxes in a way. And you pay taxes, and you get streets and schools and whatnot, and you pay dues, and you get a contract, and you get job protection, and you get health care and benefits and whatnot. So having these basic ABC discussions with workers about what it means to be in a union, what your contract means, what's in your contract, how your dues pays for your contract, and if you choose not to pay, your coworkers are paying for your contract, and have the whole work site understand that is the dynamic that is really happening. That's not just rhetoric. You know, these aren't free contracts. They cost money, dues money. So if your coworker says, I'm not paying, well, you better tell them, actually, I don't want to pay for your contract, and that's not cool. And we're not friends anymore. I mean, whatever it takes. This is a serious thing. Every time someone drops their dues, we get weaker in bargaining. And that's where the contract gets made in bargaining. And so next year, state workers, and actually 90% of our broader union goes into bargaining. And we're going into bargaining in a pretty historic situation where we have less money because of Janus. And there's going to be a lot at stake next year. It's not going to be an easy fight at the state level. So every time someone drops their dues, that makes us weaker at the bargaining table. And having those talks about how that affects bargaining, how we could be in trouble next year. You know, state workers have a lot to lose. And if we get a bad contract next year, and this is the main point, really, if we get a bad contract, you will see people tell their coworkers, the Freedom Foundation will say, why are you paying dues for a wage loss? And that'll be very compelling, and people will drop their membership by the hundreds, if not thousands even. And after that point, there's a critical point that is reached eventually where you're a busted union. If you get down to 60% membership at the bargaining table, they laugh at you, basically. So next year, I would say, is a historic moment for us in bargaining. We got to prepare our members for that. You know, what's at stake? Tell them and begin immediately organizing for that contract and mobilizing the whole state around that issue as well. This affects the whole state, you know? Well,
beyond bargaining, unions are responsible for enforcing a contract. That is, when a member or a non-member has a grievance, when they're unjustly disciplined or removed, or they didn't get, if there's wage theft, or if their hours are they're getting the wrong hours or whatever, being classified incorrectly in their job, they go to the union for representation. And if they're not a member, they're getting free servicing from the union, right?
Yeah, they are, and that's
because the union is by law obligated to represent them whether they're a member or not.
Yeah, and that's really contentious. You can, of course, it is. Like, stewards will tell me, like, I don't want to be a steward if I have to represent that worker who's not paying dues. And actually, a new steward stopped being a steward because of that. They were so upset by that fact. I would argue that if somebody is, in fact, trouble and has to go to the union and they're a non-member, that might be a moment where they see the light, basically. Now I get why it matters, you know. Like, if I'm going to get fired unjustly and you can save my job, okay, I'll pay dues now. I get it. For some workers, they go years without having to get representation in that way, and they think, well, therefore my dues mean nothing. I pay dues for nothing. Actually, you pay dues for your contract and your wages and benefits and whatnot as well. But some workers think of it only as a defense against discipline.
All right. And correct me if I'm wrong, but part of the lawsuit that Janice brought forth was that this was a violation of his First Amendment free speech rights because the union didn't have the same politics he did. Now, your dues do not go towards political action, correct?
Right. We have, most unions have a separate body, a CAPE. We call it CAPE. That's our political arm that you fund outside of dues. You can choose to pay money in addition to that, and that fund can fund politicians and whatnot, but your dues cannot go to that.
And so there's a whole other aspect of education you need to do because this lawsuit brought forth that argument that's not really accurate.
And I would say, why I tell workers when they bring that up about politics and whatnot, because SEIU is pretty progressive in their politics, and we have a statewide union, and therefore we have members across the state who might, you know, get upset about this or that policy. And let's tell them, you know what, this has nothing to do with politics. This is your contract. You pay dues for your contract. You work at the state only for this contract, not for politics. So everything else is secondary. You can be mad at the union for whatever reason. You pay dues for your contract. That's why you work here. So continue to pay dues. Don't give excuses about politics or the bureaucracy or whatever else it is. You know, keep it focused on what matters to them.
Right. So some factions of labor are saying that the decision in the Janice case is actually the best thing that's happened to labor in a while because it's forcing labor to get back to an organizing model. Do you see that happening with your union, and what are your feelings about that?
Well, I have mixed feelings. You know, saying that this is a good thing because it causes change, it forces change, there's some truth in that. You know, a lot of unions have been kind of stuck doing the same thing for a long time, and this does force a change. You know, but the cost of that could be devastating. I don't want to exaggerate or be, you know, alarmist, but our union could actually be destroyed by Janice. The biggest union in Oregon could be destroyed, and there's ramifications for all of Oregon if that happens. There's so much at stake here, so I think it's too, like, easy or willy-nilly to say, oh, it's a good thing, you know, it's forcing change. Well, it's going to force unions, some unions will not survive this, period. And it will take years, if not decades, for those workers to, like, get their voice back and their rights back. And so I have mixed feelings on that subject, pretty much. Yeah.
When you say that that your union is the biggest union in Oregon and it affects all Oregonians, can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, well, in Oregon, how politics works at the state level is essentially of two unions, SEIU and the Teachers Union, OEA, who carry the vast majority of weight politically for the working class in general.
And who does SEIU represent?
We are state workers, other public sector employees in different cities and counties. We're home care workers. We have about 50,000 members right now. Mm-hmm. And that fluctuates because of Janus also it fluctuates. And then, you know, the OEA is the teachers. And so our two unions are, you know, big and powerful, and we combine resources politically. And, you know, we have people in Salem who are lobbyists who spend a lot of their time in Salem, like, you know, crushing anti-worker bills and making threats to politicians. And they're pretty effective in what they do, and a lot of that is unseen work behind the scenes. And if you lose one of those two unions, you lose a lot. The balance of power shifts against workers. The Democrats will go to the right because, you know, a lot of the reason why they are left to the extent that they are is because they do what, to some extent, what SEIU says are the teachers, and it keeps them on a progressive pro-worker track. And if that money is gone or the union is gone, they're going to look for other backers, and that will be the right wing. There simply is no other organization on the left with the size and resources of these two unions who play ball at the state level. Other labor unions typically follow the lead of these two unions. They kind of set the pace. You know, they're part of Our Oregon, that, you know, coalition that's really, you know, the teachers and SEIU who are the major players. And then you have, you know, other unions as well, like UFCW, who also play, but, you know, they're not like the big players. So really, it's just a balance of power thing between the corporations and labor. And
UFCW is who?
United Food and Commercial Workers, the Safeway and Fred Meyer represent workers. So, and, you know, and they're at risk too, because these private sector unions expect that the Janus decision is going to trickle down to them, maybe in a future Supreme Court decision, maybe next year, where we could have a federal right to work country, where any union member can have the option to pay nothing, and that will crush a lot of unions. So, yeah, people are freaked out and trying to do their best to respond and react. And I think it is true that the good thing out of this is, you know, you have to focus on the members. The members have to sign a membership form now and be told why it matters. And that takes more discussion, more education. And ultimately, it takes a good contract. You know, like, again, like most employees are going to pay dues money for a contract that is good. And if they get bad contracts, they will think twice about paying dues. So it forces the unions to really step up their game, not settle for concessions, try their best. Like right now in Washington, the teachers' unions, you know, they are affected by Janus also. Mm-hmm. And that may be, I'm not sure exactly their situation, but that could be in part what makes them try harder. And their members can leave that union now. Mm-hmm. So fight like hell and stay in the union, and that's how you win.
And the Washington, Southern Washington teachers in 10 districts just voted 95% or 97% to strike.
And that's going to...
Maybe tomorrow. We'll talk about that later.
Well, that's going to affect Oregon. You know, we have teachers watching that struggle. We have public employees watching that struggle. Mm-hmm. SCA members in Oregon have watched the teacher strikes across the country and thought to themselves, why not us? You know, like, now's the time. Like, we have momentum. We're sick of concessions. Our living standards are dropping. So that's how you win.
What's the importance of militant tactics, you think, in keeping people in a union?
Well, again, like, it gets you better contracts. You know, there's an old saying, something along the lines of, you haven't got the best contract until you've at least prepared for a strike. Like, at least you've prepared your maximum leverage at the bargaining table via action. But I think also another reason why it's powerful is that, you know, the more workers get involved directly in the actions of the union, most workers, most of the time, and most unions are pretty passive members, you know, and they let officers or stewards do a lot of the work. And so a strike is everyone doing something, everyone experiencing the power of the union directly. And that experience, you know, and my union folks haven't been on strike since 95. And those workers who are still working today will say, like, that changed my life, mm-hmm. you know. So,
do Can you say something about the 87 strike or the 95 strike? Do you know about that? I mean, that's before your time, I suppose.
It was, but you know, it's like folklore in the union. You know, that's kind of how our union was born mm-hmm. and made strong. Mm-hmm. So 87 was the rolling strike, and after that strike,
the rolling strike.
Yeah, after that strike happened, they outlawed the tactic.
Yeah, I remember. The management didn't know from day to day which unit was going to go out.
And they called it anarchy, and you know, they melted down completely. And in 95, we struck to protect PERS.
PERS is?
The pension system for state workers, uh-huh. for all public employees in Oregon, for most anyways. And that today is still an issue that needs to be refought.
Yeah. Because yeah, they revisit it, it feels like, every session.
Yeah, it's so dangerous because, you know, we're in this perpetual austerity mindset, you know, which means just like cuts forever, cutting services, cutting education, cutting wages for the workers, cutting taxes for the wealthy and corporations. And so this is an endless cycle of cuts, and they're always revisiting ways to cut the pension, ways to cut the health care to save money. You know, public employees in Oregon, they're teachers, social workers, firefighters, police, you know, like every aspect of our society is affected by this. And people you know and your family and whatnot, and just like perpetual punching bags. And it's exhausting.
And we have no services to offer anymore either, it feels like, because of, you know, the things that our administration has done this, you know, over the time that he's been in office. And to take away what we've actually bargained for at the table is just one more, you know, of those thousand cuts that are killing us.
Yeah, it's hard to look at it in the totality of, you know, broader politics that is bipartisan. You know, the Republicans are worse, of course. They want to cut harder, faster, and that's like the big difference only. You know, the Democrats are kind of for the status quo and cutting slower, more strategically. But people don't like the status quo. That's part of the problem, you know. So I do think if Kate Brown gets reelected, which is not a certain thing at all,
I know,
that she'll be less dangerous than Newt Euler. You know, kind of like how Hillary was going to be less dangerous than Trump. But it's hard to convince people to vote for a very boring Kate Brown, just like it was for a very boring Hillary Clinton, especially when you knew that they were going to take action against us, you know, but less drastic.
Yeah, that's a conundrum.
So talk again a little bit about why the Janus decision and the undercutting of, or the right to work legislation against public sector has a possibility or potential of rolling into the private sector and undercutting private sector workers as well.
Well, I'm not an expert on that. I've heard from union officials and organizers and private sector unions that are assuming that this will be a precedent of sorts that'll be turned on them soon. Just like before the Harris versus Quinn decision of the Supreme Court, after that was passed, like, oh, now Janus was going to pass, or now there's going to be a public sector, broader expansion of this idea. So the ideas that are being passed at the Supreme Court, they think those will grow and expand, and they know what the intentions are of these people putting forth these policies. So that I think that's the obvious end goal, is have a nation of, you know, precarious unions.
Okay, well, if you just tuned in, this is KBOO Portland Labor Radio. We're talking with Seamus Cook, who's an activist, chief steward with Service Employees International Union, Local 503, talking about Janus versus AFSCME, the effect of a Supreme Court decision that eliminates agency fee for public sector worker, public sector union members. So we've talked a little bit about how union contracts impact their members and the importance of unions for those people who are members or who are represented by unions. But what's the impact of the kind of wages, hours, and working conditions and benefits that you're able to negotiate on people who are not in unions? Why is it important for folks to fight these right-to-work laws, these laws that weaken unions who are not in unions? Why is it important for folks who are not in unions to defend unions?
Well, that's a difficult question, I think. In one way, it's the labor market at large, right? So public employees, they do work that other workers do in the private sector as well. And so it's about standards, raising standards for all workers. And unions artificially shift the market to a more pro-worker stance. So knowing that is helpful, I think. And I think just the teachers, for example, when you see that happening, when you see unions take action, that inspires other workers to join unions. You know, unions right now have a pretty positive, there's a positive opinions about unions for young people especially, you know, and there's very few organizations in the working class right now that are strong at all. And those who take action, you know, show strength, that's sort of inspiring and empowering for people. And most people nowadays in the working class don't feel empowered or inspired. So that to me is one of the main things that we can do that can show all workers. You should join a union too, you know, like you can join our union, you know, like get involved somehow. You don't have to, your work does not have to be, you know, void of dignity, basically.
Yeah, it's like when folks ask you, or not ask you, but comment on, well, you only have those good wages because you're in a union. And I always like to come back with, well, you could work on getting those same wages by organizing at your workplace. Jamie and I were at a training this weekend where it was probably about maybe 25% non-union folks in the room that were interested in just bringing up the standards in their workplace through collective action. And that's really what it's all about.
Yeah, and there's this misperception that's caused by the media, of course, that treats unionized workers as, you know, like having a ton of money and being driving fancy cars and whatnot, and that is just not the case. You know, most of my coworkers are just working class people who've got kids and are struggling to make ends meet. They don't make that much money, and there's thousands of workers at the state who are on food stamps. You know, like this is not like a high-end job. Although there are some positions at the state, upper bureaucracy and whatnot, that they make some good money. But on average, this goes on average for all working class jobs and unions even. You know, if you're a carpenter or electrician or a teacher, you're not making that much money really. Although sometimes, in relative to like a low-wage worker, it could seem like a lot. But really we have to be thinking about, okay, the problem is the low-wage worker, not the worker who's making a living wage, you know.
And if you're thinking about organizing a union, you can actually Google it. How do I organize a union? That's some basic steps you go through. You talk one-on-one with your coworkers, and you pull together a committee, and you figure out a strategy, and maybe reach out to an existing union to get some assistance, some resource. But anyway, do you have something about that?
Yeah, well, I think that might be also be a consequence of Janus, is that some of these unions, my own included, have like pulled back a little bit on organizing new unions.
Mm-hmm.
It's all around harder right now with Trump in charge of the National Labor Relations Board, appointing people, whatnot. So there's that, and then you have less resources to organize new unions, and you know, if you're not careful, you get in a pattern where you're just kind of shrinking and, you know, looking inwards. And yes, it's true that we have to like be strong inward at the same time. It comes to a question of how do you prioritize your resources as well, you know? I would argue right now in our union we have a fight to be fought, and that's the priority.
So what would your advice be to other public sector unionists who are now living with the loss of representation fees by non-members?
Well, I think education is key, and you know, not a lot of people are great having these conversations with their coworkers or with their members about how to talk about this, what it means, and what's at stake. You know, part of organizing is urgency. You know, you have to take action. This is urgent. You can't just sit on your hands and do nothing. And talking about how, for all unions under Janus now, every bargain session is life or death. It needs to be treated like that. You got to mobilize all the members. It has to be like a very inclusive. The whole process has to change and be much more aggressive and much more education involved. And if it's not, then you're gonna suffer badly.
What do you mean by aggressive?
Well, just you know, typically bargaining is how it's been. Is kind of like, oh, it's been routine. This is how we do
it. Very civil.
Very civil, routine, and you know, the members are, you know, they're put into action here, there, you know, sometimes half-heartedly.
Wear a t-shirt here.
Yeah, but there's no expectation around the possibility of a strike. That's like off the table pretty much. And so that's one of the main things. We actually have to organize to prepare for a strike every time we bargain. And if we don't, the members are going to say, we didn't try hard enough, and therefore I'm not paying dues. There's always an exit sign now for these people, You got to show everyone you tried as hard as you could to get the best possible contract. And if you do that effectively, they'll stay in the union.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my union's in contract bargaining right now. And when we started our discussion around going into bargaining, what we did that timeline back, right? And the timeline didn't start with a signed contract. It started with the strike. Because we said if we're going to open, because we haven't opened in many years, we have to be prepared to strike because our members are so hungry for change in this contract. And that's the message we took to people with, you know, if we're going to open, this is where potentially we're going to end up. Are we ready for that? And our members said they were.
And that's the cultural shift that needs to happen in most unions, because the word strike has been off the table for so long. And to think in that way requires a huge shift. To be prepared to take action to defend your contract mm-hmm. is a huge shift that needs to happen immediately. And there's no shortcuts around it. There's no ways to innovate yourself out of this. There's lots of talk about, oh, a post-Janus world for unions. What does that mean? Well, it means the same thing. But actually, it means turning backwards and looking back and seeing when we were militant and stronger. Mm-hmm. That's what we have to get back. There's no new fancy ways to fix this.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And I think that the wildcat strikes by the teachers, et cetera, are really showing that we have to get back to our roots to make that change.
Absolutely.
I'd like to just shift the conversation for a few minutes. We're nearing the end of our show. But for those listeners who turned on their radio tonight to hear Jason Scheckler talking about fighting racism and fascism, I want to share with you at least the bits of a resolution from the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters, who, in response to the hate groups that have been demonstrating on our streets and harassing particular peoples, the Carpenters came up with this statement that hate groups have stated that they will stage menacing provocations, which they have. And when we're talking about folks like the Proud Boys here in the Pacific Northwest, this resolution talks about groups like the KKK and other racist organizations. And it says they represent a deadly threat to African Americans, Latinos, immigrants, Muslims, Jews, and other marginalized religious groups, LGBTQ, and among others, and represented threat directly to the members of our union. The white supremacist forces are related to the origins of anti-labor right to work laws. Did you all know that? In order to destroy union, they wanted to destroy unions because they believed unions would lead to uniting and empowering the multinational, multiracial working class to resist the attacks. So we're living in a period of crisis of racist organizing and attacks, and the labor movement must take up the struggle against white supremacy and white nationalism, not as an abstract debate, but as part of its social, political, and organizing agenda. So this is a statement of the Carpenters Council, the North Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters, and they say that they stand ready to join with the broader labor and social justice community mobilizing against the clear and present danger that provocations of racist and fascist organizations pose to us all. And I have to say that over the last year, I have seen the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters show up in immigrant rights mobilizations, in mobilizations against the Proud Boys and others. They've been there. They've been true to their word. And I know that Jason would have had a lot to say about that. And just wanted to give Amanda and Seamus an opportunity to talk about why it's important for labor movement to be part of this opposition to the racist and fascist mobilizing that's happening, especially in the age of Trump.
Well, in my union, our members are all those groups that are vulnerable, first of all. Mm-hmm. They're all members of our union, so we have to protect them. But the larger force is fascism is a right-wing movement, a far-right movement, and the workers' movement is part of the left. And so they see us as an adversary. They understand the social forces, that they're their opposition. So you have to understand that, and I think and unions have to do a better job, mine included, of education around these issues, why it matters. this is a complicated dynamic that you really could and should focus on for your members, why this matters. Talk about that, first of all, you know, like the role of unions in this dynamic, you know, what it means to be, fascism is not just a bunch of racists. They serve like a purpose politically, and mm-hmm. their expansion is going to come at our expense and vice versa. So if we're strong and organized against this, we can minimize their threat, as we should.
I'm in total agreement with that. Our union is beginning the conversation. It's been a little bit more difficult in our union to bring up the topic, I think. Caregivers tend to give people the benefit of the doubt, I think, in a lot of ways, but it does affect many members of our union, as well as the people that we serve, right? The people that walk into our hospitals and clinics. And one of the things we're doing in our bargaining is we're considering putting in language around protection of immigrants and the giving them the time they need to go to hearings on citizenship and things like that to ensure that the employer does the right thing by them.
Great. You know, we're going to have to wrap up. I'm sorry, we're out of time. And that wraps it up for this edition of Labor Radio every Monday at 6 p.m. I want to give thanks to Mike, our engineer, and stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Produced at the studio.